In the coming week, a U.S. expert panel reviews lifting the Johnson & Johnson vaccine pause. President Biden addresses Congress, and the best international feature films are judged at the 93rd Academy Awards. It's April 22nd, 2021, and time for The World Next Week. I'm Bob McMahon.
And I'm Jim Lindsay. Bob, tomorrow, Friday, April 23rd, the expert panel advising the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention is expected to announce a decision about whether to resume administering the Johnson & Johnson COVID-19 vaccine. The decision to halt, at least temporarily, use of the single-shot vaccine has had consequences for the vaccine effort in the United States and also around the globe. Can you update us on the state of play over the Johnson & Johnson vaccine, Bob?
Sure, Jim. First of all, let's again note it was the U.S. Center for Disease Control and the Food and Drug Administration that announced the pause after the vaccine officials reported 6 cases of cerebral venous sinus thrombosis, which is a rare type of blood clot, and it is seen in combination with low levels of blood platelets. It is rare, but the cases were especially strong and seemed to be analogous to what was being reported with the AstraZeneca vaccine in Europe, so they put a halt on it. It was significant, and it's going to be very closely watched. The review tomorrow, following the review by the European Union's drug regulator earlier this week, which said while there's a possible link between the J&J vaccine and the cases of a rare type of blood clot, they emphasized that the shot's benefits outweighed the risks of side effects. And I'll tell you a little bit about the benefits, Jim, because it's worth repeating that while the Pfizer and Moderna vaccines came and rated very highly in terms of their effectiveness in warding off any sort of spread of COVID-19 and have not shown any major side effects, certainly of the nature of blood clots. The Johnson & Johnson one came in also rated fairly highly, and it's a one dose as opposed to a two dose vaccine. And there's also this cold chain needed to keep Pfizer and Moderna vaccines from spoiling. And so one dose, cheaper, you get your one and done. It was seen as an important introduction to the vaccine rollout, not only in the United States, Jim, but internationally. They have a whole host of clients signed up around the world, J&J does, including, among other countries, Brazil, Canada, Peru, Chile, and New Zealand. They had just cut a deal with the African Union to provide African nations with something like 400 million doses of the vaccine. So there was a lot at stake again with the J&J vaccine getting a green light or perhaps a cautionary thumbs up as the European regulators announced earlier this week.
Bob, do we see an emerging consensus over the wisdom of putting the Johnson & Johnson vaccine on pause? In the immediate aftermath, I read a lot of articles in which people pointed out that the number of adverse reactions was very small. I think it was something like 6 or 7 out of 7 million shots. Many people pointing out that a lot of medicines taken routinely by Americans, at least, have a much higher rate of adverse reactions. And that led to criticisms that the pause in J&J was going to increase the so-called vaccine hesitancy in the United States. How do you see that playing out?
So, Jim, you've seized on really the crux of the issue here, and something that I think highlights just how difficult it is to be a public health official at this point amidst a global pandemic. Damned if you do and damned if you don't, it seems like, in terms of if you're a health official and you're presented with small but very compelling signs that, a small group of people could be very severely adversely affected, do you brush it off and say the greater good and the greater purpose of this is to roll this out? Or do you show, due diligence, pause it for a little while, check it out, and then go ahead and say, here's what it does, here's what our confidence level is, and we are being transparent with the public. They're going to lose either way with some people who are inclined to be skeptical of vaccines. And we're seeing this even in the United States. We've seen this slowdown now after an incredible rollout of vaccines. And it's something that happens around the world. I think we've seen it with the AstraZeneca rollout, where some countries have just said, we're not doing it ever. Denmark, I think, just decided to do that in recent days. You've had other countries as well, weighing in and just sort of striking that off their list, even as they're dealing with surging virus rates. So I think it's the European regulators' ruling was very interesting. It remains to be seen what sort of public take-up there will be. There had been a little bit of a wariness in terms of people taking the J&J vaccine while Moderna and Pfizer options were also available in the United States. And again, those two have won a great deal of confidence, even while they're a two-shot combo and they have special storing requirements. And Johnson & Johnson is now facing this bar of, can they be accepted? The other thing, Jim, to consider, though, is you still don't have really this coordinated global vaccine rollout effort. Johnson & Johnson Johnson was supposed to be part of that. In the absence of that, you've had spots around the world where you've had the Chinese vaccine provided or the Russian one, and there's not a great deal of transparency in what went into the sort of the final testing of those and what kind of impact they're having. But some of the signals are in that they're not very effective. I think Chile is grappling with a surge in COVID cases, and it had been reliant to some extent on the Chinese vaccine. And you've actually had some discussions and some public pronouncement by Chinese officials that they are looking to beef up the effectiveness of their vaccine. So it's all against the backdrop as well of a pandemic that's raging in parts of the world. India is now counting the highest ever case total anyone has seen in the world. And you're having, you know, something like 5.2 million new cases overall recorded in the world last week. And that's the highest since the pandemic began. Again, the stakes couldn't be any higher to have a vaccine that is, I think, by many experts regarded as quite effective being held up because of concern over a statistically small case of very negative side effects.
Well, I think in some sense, the pause for Johnson & Johnson was almost inevitable because, as you point out, the regulators are caught between a rock and a hard place. If they hadn't, then the story would have been that they had not stopped to investigate this. And I do think, unfortunately, it is going to fuel some degree of vaccine hesitancy in the United States and overseas, even though it is quite clear from all the available evidence that the Johnson & Johnson vaccine benefits clearly outweigh the risk. And the interesting thing here, and certainly for high-income countries that have good medical systems, you know exactly what kind of adverse outcome to look for, and it is treatable. So in that sense, that's a positive sign. But I also believe Johnson & Johnson is being hurt by problems with what I understand is a production facility in Baltimore, which initially didn't follow protocols, leading to something like 15 million spoiled doses. And now I believe that production facility has revealed more problems, which I think is going to add to the concern that potential recipients will have and say, I don't want the Johnson & Johnson. And of course, the question becomes, you know, if it's between Johnson & Johnson and nothing, is that really the wise choice to make? I'll note on the Chinese vaccine that the evidence there isn't about producing potential adverse outcomes in a small sliver of recipients, but that it doesn't work at all, which is an entirely different thing. And this gets us back into the question of vaccine nationalism and vaccine diplomacy. And the Chinese had gone out and made a big deal of providing their vaccine to a lot of countries at low cost. And this was seen as sort of emboldening and aiding Chinese soft power. It appears to be going in exactly the opposite direction now, that the Chinese, at least on this score, are getting a reputation for talking a very big game and producing very little in the way of results. Just one last thing quickly. You mentioned India, which is significant because India is one of the world's largest producers of vaccines, tremendous capacity on that score. And the expectation is that India would be producing vaccines that could go to the rest of the world. But I think right now the Indian government, for understandable reasons, is saying our problems here at home are so significant that we have to make sure we get doses to our people to curb the overwhelming surge that we're having, a surge that is overwhelming India's hospital and healthcare system. So these are all very interesting things to watch. I'll just say broadly, we live in a world of some 7 billion people. It is going to be very difficult and take quite a long time to vaccinate people, particularly if it's the case, as we're seeing evidence to suggest, that getting a vaccination in and of itself is not going to be sufficient, that you might need booster shots because of the variants that are emerging. And of course, the more people who go unvaccinated, whether they are in India or in Senegal or they are in California, you create more potential for variants which the current vaccines may not recognize. So this is a significant issue, and it suggests that we're facing maybe an endemic and continuing problem, not something that we can just sort of check off come the fall of 2021.
Yeah, that last point can't be stressed highly enough, is that this really needs to be done globally. And we also were entering a period where you might have by this summer a pretty sizable surplus in supply in the United States, partly due to people, you know, being reluctant to take the vaccine, but also with the paucity of supply in many other parts of the world. So the U.S. And the Biden administration have some big decisions and some big actions to mull in the months ahead, Jim.
I'll just simply note quickly on that point that a number of the contracts signed under the Trump administration actually limits the ability of the Biden administration to provide surplus doses to other countries. The whole complex set of legal reasons for that. But in some sense, the Biden team is not coming to it with sort of a blank sheet of paper free to do as it sees fit. And of course, there is an optics problem here at home. If you were seen as sending doses overseas, when there are people here at home who want to get vaccinated and have yet to be vaccinated.
Well, Jim, let's stick with the Biden administration and President Biden himself, who will be delivering a speech to a joint session of Congress next Wednesday. It's expected to be a rather broad review of the historic challenges like the pandemic facing the country. Jim, can you talk a bit about what he might be discussing in the speech that we should keep our eye on?
Happy to do so, Bob. Let's sort of begin with what the likely goals of the speech are. I can see two. One is to make the case that President Biden has notched major successes during his first 3 months in office. And the second one is to argue that much more remains to be done and that big, bold solutions are needed to tackle those problems. Now, I should point out for people who are purists that this is not a State of the Union speech, and it also won't look like any typical speech given by a president to a joint session of Congress. Only about 200 people will be in the room with the president, and that's because of restrictions over COVID-19. So this is a real tough ticket to get, and I will note that many House Republicans will not be in the chamber when President Biden speaks, and that's because the House will be out of session next week, and many House Republicans will be in Florida for a House GOP conference. So the optics are going to look different than what we're used to seeing when a president goes into the well of the House to speak to Congress and through Congress to the nation. And I suspect that when President Biden gives his speech, he's going to tout his successes, and I think that is going to begin with the topic we were just talking about, COVID-19. You recall that when Biden first became president, he promised that he would get 100 million shots in his first 100 days, subsequently up that to 200 million shots in his first 100 days. I believe that the administration has hit or surpassed that target. So I think, again, Biden will come back and say, we said job one was getting the pandemic under control. We have made substantial steps at doing that. I expect after that, the president to pivot to talking about the problems that remain and to talk about his policies for tackling those problems. And again, I think we're going to hear a lot more about his infrastructure plan. We're going to hear about the so-called American Family Plan, which I believe the White House plans to roll out before the speech. This is a plan that would raise taxes on the rich to fund child care and education. And I think the interesting thing to watch there is that Biden will be speaking as much to his fellow Democrats as he will be to the Republicans. There are considerable divisions within the Democratic Party over a number of these issues, with moderates worrying that the Biden plans are too big and progressives arguing that they don't go far enough. And with the margin so small in both houses and no signs of Republicans being willing to cross the aisle, almost every member of Congress becomes pivotal. And the real big question mark, Bob, is going to be what Biden says about foreign policy. Now, obviously, foreign affairs is not top of the mind for most Americans. Got a lot of problems here at home with the pandemic, with jobs, with issues of racial equity, economic inequality, and the like. But obviously, the world doesn't go on pause while we stay and deal with our work at home. And indeed, things could change quite rapidly. We've talked recently about how tumultuous world events are right now. Obviously, the big concern being China. That's a long-term challenge. But in the near term, real concerns about what is happening around Ukraine with the Russian buildup. Russian President Vladimir Putin gave his State of Russia speech yesterday. It was quite pugnacious. He talked about what would happen if people crossed Russia's red lines, reminded everybody about Russia's nuclear modernization. I think that caught a number of people's eyes, particularly against the backdrop in Russia of mass protests about Alexei Navalny's imprisonment, health, and really condemnation of Putin's leadership. That makes that a dicey situation. And of course, you get to add in Iran and North Korea. So there's no lack of big issues on the foreign policy front, even as you're likely to get a speech that is going to talk about issues here at home.
Jim, I'd like to mention, those are all obviously really big issues, and it would be interesting if he has anything to declare after the climate summit that's taking place as we're taping this podcast. But I'm also wondering whether or not there's going to be any movement or room for movement dealing with immigration issues, considering the ongoing real crisis, I guess I would say, at the border, an area where the Republicans have seized on Biden administration steps or what they say are missteps in contributing to a surge in migrants there. And also there have been reports, though, that, you know, there might be some Republican senators willing to cross the aisle and talk about comprehensive immigration reform. Any sense that that's going to be a place for any sort of bipartisan gestures?
Well, you're quite right, Bob, that Biden almost certainly has to talk about immigration, and particularly the status of the southern border. That is a big issue. And obviously, you look at the public opinion polls, it is a source of his greatest political vulnerability. That's not lost on Republicans. That's why they've been hitting him on the surge of people trying to cross the border over and over again. At the same time, it creates problems for him with many Democrats. As you know, last week, the Biden administration let it be known that they weren't going to raise the cap on refugees. That led to an outcry among Democrats. So the administration backtracked and is now talking about raising the cap. How much it will raise it is unknown. You need to keep in mind that candidate Biden had argued that he would raise the limit on refugees coming into the United States. This is going to be an issue that he is going to have to address in the speech he gives. I imagine he will call for bipartisan cooperation. That's the tenor of many of these speeches. And as much as I would like to believe that bipartisan cooperation on immigration is coalescing, I find it hard to believe that that is going to happen. We've had talk about bipartisan cooperation immigration for a number of years now, more than a decade. It has never really materialized. Occasionally, you do get members who show some political courage to doing it, and then the political winds just become overwhelming and those bids fall apart.
And as you mentioned, there'll be sort of alternate universes with many Republicans at another location. And I've also seen reports that the Senate Republicans and the House Republicans are going to get together and choose someone to issue a rebuttal like they would after a State of the Union as well. So we'll have to see how that pans out.
Yes, you're right, Bob. Republicans are going to give a response to the president's speech. We don't know who is going to deliver that response. Also interesting to note that a progressive group known as the Working Families Party also plans to deliver an official response to Biden's speech. And it will be freshman House member Jamal Bowman, a Democrat from New York, who is going to deliver that response. And I suspect he is going to be speaking for many people in the progressive wing of the Democratic Party. And it's going to be interesting to see what kind of tone he strikes, whether it is combative or it is supportive of President Biden's main agenda. And again, if you look at the Democratic Party, they all run under the same banner, but I think there's a fair amount of disagreement on which issues the administration should attack and with which priority and with how much in the way of resources. And there really is this question about how big should the administration's plans be.
All right, so we will get another taste of domestic drama and potentially with a foreign policy flavor next week, Jim.
But let's actually switch gears, Bob, and try to do something on a slightly lighter note. And we will do what has become a standing segment on The World Next Week over the years. And that is to discuss the Academy Award nomination for films in the Best International Feature Film category. So tell me, Bob, because I haven't been to a movie theater in a very long time, who's been nominated?
I think we're all missing, I certainly am, the sort of art house experience of being able to go in and check out an international feature film, aside from the multiplex experience where you rarely see these foreign films. But let me run down the list. There are five candidates for Best International Feature Film, Jim. Three are from Europe. They are Denmark's Entry, which is Another Round. And quickly, this is about four high school teachers who test a theory that they can improve their lives by maintaining a constant level of alcohol in their blood. Another one that I actually just happened to watch and was really gripping was called Quo Vadis Aida from Bosnia and Herzegovina, which is, it creates a fictional personal tale about the very real event surrounding the Srebrenica massacre of 1995, taking a family of a woman who's serving as a UN translator and sort of showing what they went through in those awful days and weeks in the summer of 1995. Another entry from Europe is from Romania and it's called Collective. And this deals another real life situation involving a tragedy, a fire at a club called Collective, but the sort of multiple tragedy involved the way that the burn victims from this club fire were treated using a faulty treatment, and there was sort of a major healthcare fraud involved. There was political corruption involved and deaths of many innocent civilians. So a real kind of muckraking, engrossing piece on a really difficult issue. And then a film from Tunisia called The Man Who Sold His Skin, which sort of follows this Syrian man who's fled to Lebanon to escape the Syrian war, who's yearning to be joining his significant other in Paris, but sort of the travails that he goes through, and sort of a broader statement about the treatment of refugees and the sort of forgotten nature of the Syrian conflict. And then finally, number five is called Better Days. This is a Hong Kong entry. Doesn't get into any of the politics roiling that territory at the moment, but more sort of an anti-bullying film, actually, about a bullied teenage girl who forms a friendship with a young man, turns out to be someone who protects her, and they get involved in all sorts of criminal incidents and so forth. And it's sort of an interesting journey through the lens of this teenage girl. And so what's interesting also is Hong Kong usually have been sort of a given that you could watch the Academy Award ceremonies live. Chinese authorities who've been clamping down across the board in Hong Kong are not going to allow that to happen, presumably for risk of something being said that could rile up the public. So there will be some censorship going on, contributing to the viewing of the Academy Award ceremony in Hong Kong. I would just add a couple of quick things also about the regular nominated films. There's a bit of an international flair to some of them. One of them is called Minari, and the director is Lee Isaac Chung, who's the son of Korean immigrants, and it kind of recounts his family's tale as an immigrant family growing up in Arkansas. And then the director of another highly lauded film, Nomadland, is Beijing-born. Her name is Chloe Zhao. And so she just earned a Best Film at the BAFTA Awards and was also Best Picture Drama at the Golden Globe. So as always, and increasingly, there is an international influence on the Academy Awards, Jim.
Well, I would think, Bob, that there has been increasing international influence on almost all visual media. When I turn on Netflix, I have to say I've been watching a lot of shows that are foreign in origin, whether it's, you know, Borgen, which is about the Danish Parliament, or Stiesel, which I thought was absolutely wonderful with an ultra-Orthodox family in Jerusalem. And the list can go on in terms of sort of things like movies and television shows crossing national borders in this globalized world. But going back to those films that have been nominated in this category, is there a film that looks to be a front runner that is Secretariat and everyone expects it to take home the award? Or is this one of these things where it's a coin toss and all of the entrants are on the edge of their seat thinking that maybe they might be the one who gets the prize?
It's a good question, Jim. And that kind of speculation is always rife at this moment ahead of the Academy Awards for all categories, really. But same applies to the international feature films. And it seems like the early money, so to speak, is on the Danish entry, Another Round, or also known as Druk Danish. I think it's partially because of the way it's performed in other film festivals. Denmark is usually a very strong contender for Oscars. Danish submissions have been nominated 12 times, and they've been three winners in the past. The star of that movie is actually a very well-known international actor, Mads Mikkelsen. You know, people might recognize him from James Bond movies, but certainly a lot of other ones as well. So you sort of have this major crossover actor involved. Whereas the one that I mentioned before that I have seen, Quo Vadis Aida, these are all look to be all Bosnian actors. So not well known, probably outside of Bosnia or the Balkans, but nonetheless giving really strong performances. But I think sometimes that the star power can contribute to that. They all are one way or another message movies too, Jim. But again, what I've seen is the movie Another Round might be the one that's got the nod at this point. But I also would add, Jim, your point about the streaming crossing borders. I think that was happening before the pandemic, but I think it really accelerated under the pandemic, obviously with so many movie theaters closed, some movie companies actually going out of business, but the streaming companies really jumping in and some of them producing their own cinematic movies in any event. And so you've had this just glut of options and the quality of this, the series, you know, whether it could be a 5 or 6 part series, for example, are so high that I think they are competing with a 2 hour feature length movie as well. And I'm just kind of running out of time for being able to watch all the ones that have been recommended, including the ones you mentioned. I just started on Borgen, but I haven't seen Stiesel yet. I want to see that. And there's a bunch of others lining up behind it.
Well, I've watched a lot of foreign TV shows and movies during the pandemic because I used to be able to travel and see places. And now I don't get to travel and see places. So I'm living vicariously. I also highly recommend Call My Agent. Even if you don't like the plot line, it has lovely scenes of Paris, which remains my favorite city. But always good to see movies and TV shows made in other places, because I think in many ways it just reminds you is no matter how different we are as human beings, we deal with all the same issues.
But I think that's a good point that you made as well about seeing Paris. I think it's in these lockdown mode that we're going to be in for, you know, multiple months still. This is the way to vicariously travel in some places and kind of immerse yourself in some place that you're not going to see in person for a while. So, you know, what better way than to just kind of check it out in this regard around a compelling story. Well, Jim, we've talked our way into the audience figure of the week portion of the podcast. And a reminder that listeners can vote on or tweet us at CFR_org with figures of the week. But this week, our audience selected President of Chad Killed. So, Jim, it's been a story unfolding this week. Can you tell us about the significance of the death of the president of Chad?
Happy to, Bob, but I have to confess up front that this is one of the murkier news story to break in recent years. The president of Chad is Idriss Deby, and he's been president of Chad since about 1990. Official reports are that he was killed in a battle in the northern part of the country in fighting against rebel forces known as the Front for Change in Concord in Chad, goes by the French acronym FACT. But we don't know why Deby was on the front lines, how he was killed, or who precisely killed him. Further clouding things is that Deby's presidency has seen a number of coup attempts, which raises questions again about the circumstances of his death. And ironically, his death came just as he was being announced the winner of Chad's April 11th presidential election. But maybe this point I should sort of step back a bit and just sort of locate everything for people. Chad is a landlocked country in Central Africa. It's about three times the size of California, and has a population of about 17 million people. Now, again, as I mentioned, Deby has been president since 1990. He took power in a coup. He's been elected president six times. Let me put elected in quotation marks. He's an authoritarian feared by many of his people. And while he's not well known to Americans, the United States has been a partner with him in the bid to counter Islamic extremism in the region. And if you think of Chad, it has Libya to the north, it has Nigeria to the southwest, Sudan to the east. There have been about 50 to maybe 70 U.S. military advisors in Chad, helping train and advise the Chadian military. France has been an even more significant partner. And indeed, the fighting that reportedly killed Deby involves a combination of Chadian and French troops fighting against FACT forces. And I'll note that the French government spokesman said that with Deby's death, France had lost a courageous friend. Now, Deby's being succeeded by his 37-year-old son, who is supposed to head a transitional military council that will lead to new elections in 18 months. That's not the line of succession as laid out in Chad's constitution. That constitution talks about either the president of the National Assembly succeeding the president, or failing that, the first vice president. So there are a lot of questions here, you know, among them, you know, can Deby's son or the military council, if they are the true power behind him, keep their hold on power? If they do, what will be the cost? Will elections ever come? Are we going to see a contest for power in Chad? If so, what does that mean for the country's stability? How might that play into the broader challenge of Islamic extremism? Will FACT be able to exploit Deby's death and any divisions it create, you know, to overthrow the regime? So all of a sudden, a country in Central Africa that the United States and France have counted on to be a pillar of their counterterrorism strategy is very much in play.
Yeah, Jim, and hearing you kind of recount all those factors, it's hard not to be pessimistic about its prospects in any sort of kind of short to medium term, certainly. From what I've seen, Chad tends to measure among the world's lowest in various human development indices, and yet it gets a large amount of very high caliber military support from countries like France, which seems to only further strengthen the military, which is its elite outfit. So again, lending a little bit of murkiness to what might have happened to President Deby, but also making it seem like, you know, the real problems of this country don't look to be settled anytime soon, especially as you throw in the jihadi influence, the rising influence there. I think in almost every obit I saw related to the Chadian president, a staunch anti-jihadist ally was inserted in there. So you throw that in there, it seems like, you know, any sort of possibility for any kind of change there, certainly internationally, if not regionally, the African Union has tried to influence, you know, peaceful transitions of power in recent years. It doesn't seem like any of that's going to happen.
Yeah, well, again, I think just a lot is in play, and we don't know exactly how it's in play because we don't really even understand the circumstances that led to Deby's death. But again, as you look at across the Sahel, the issue of jihadi violence, Islamic extremism remains a pressing one. Again, just think of Chad. To the southwest, on its borders, you have Boko Haram. To the north, again, you have Libya, which has been basically in a free-for-all since the overthrow of Muammar Gaddafi a decade minute ago. Some recent signs are reasonably positive, but still a country in considerable turmoil. You go further west and you go up to places like Mali, which we've talked about before, really big challenges. And I think you're going to have more of that rather than less of that. And I think that's a real concern because it makes all of those human development problems you alluded to all the worse. It makes them worse partly because money is getting spent on weapons rather than on solving root problems. But the rebel forces, the terrorist attacks are designed to upend daily life, and that sort of worsens the development problems that you face.
And that's our look at the world next week in both fact and fiction. Here are some other stories to keep an eye on. A constitutional referendum takes place in Haiti. The 35th anniversary of Chernobyl's disaster is marked. And the regional group ASEAN holds a summit on the worsening situation in Myanmar.
Please subscribe to The World Next Week on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. And leave us a review while you're at it. They help us get noticed and improve the show. Please note that opinions expressed in The World Next Week are solely those of the host or our guests, not of CFR, which takes no institutional position on matters of policy. Today's program is produced by Zoe Collis with senior producer Jeremy Sherlock. Zoe did double duty as a recording engineer. Thank you, Zoe. Special thanks go out to Anna Shortridge and Bethany Wright for their assistance. Our theme music is provided by Miguel Herrero and licensed under Creative Commons. This is Jim Lindsay saying goodbye.
And this is Bob McMahon saying so long and stay healthy out there.